from Microbe TV. This is TWiN, This Week in Neuroscience, episode number 55, recorded on October 14th, 2024. I'm Vincent Racaniello, and you're listening to the podcast about the nervous system. Joining me today from Salt Lake City, Jason Shepherd.
Good morning, Vincent.
Got winter out there yet?
No, but supposedly it's going to snow on Friday, but we've had record heat like almost every day for the last 2 weeks. Still in the 80s here, which is crazy.
Wow. Also joining us from New York, Tim Chung.
Hello. Hi, everyone. I don't know what 80s mean in terms of temperature. It sounds like it's boiling, but here it's 18 Celsius in New York, which might be actually cooler than in Salt Lake City.
Tim, for example, 82F would be 28C.
Oh, is that one of those palindromic? I should know from TWiV because you guys talk about the Celsius and Fahrenheit conversion all the time, but yeah. I just refuse to learn it. It's one of those things that I actually actively refuse to learn.
Well,
sorry.
If you commit to a Celsius scale, you shouldn't convert. You should feel what it's like in Celsius, right? That's the whole point.
Yeah, the metric system makes sense. It is when water freezes and boils, not when some weird salt kind of concoction freezes and boils.
So yeah, I'm with you. but I still, I feel like I've been in America long enough that I can go back and forth. But yeah, it's 20 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it should be this time of year.
So that's like about 10 Celsius.
Yeah, it should be certainly below 20 centigrade, and now it's been above 20 centigrade for, yeah.
Mm. You enjoy these conversations about science. We'd love to have your support, science and weather and other things. Microbe.tv/contribute. All right, today we're going to talk about transmeridian travel, among other things, which is also known as jet lag, right, Tim?
yes. So a few episodes ago, we talked about one form of timing, which is just us estimating kind of an arbitrary interval. For example, hey, come grab me in like, 5 minutes, that kind of timing. But today we're going to talk about a timing that has evolved with us since day one, I guess, which is circadian timing. So this is about how Earth spins around its own axis about once 24 hours. And the sun comes, sets, and rises kind of roughly once every 12 hours, but also changes as the season comes and goes. So now we're going from autumn to winter. So the day's getting shorter and shorter in the Northern Hemisphere. And as it happens, our brain can actually adapt to it. And when our brain don't adapt to it, things can go kind of a bit wrong. So the most famous case, disorder that is associated with this kind of seasonal change in daylight length is this thing called SAD, S-A-D, which stands for seasonal affective disorder. So if you're from one of the Nordic countries, or maybe just Canada, or also Alaska, also Russia, basically way up north or way down south. As the day length gets shorter and shorter, people report more and more depression. And interestingly, the treatment is that you just have a really bright light that you kind of stare into kind of early morning, just to kind of retrain, get some more sunlight into your brain so that it kind of helps your mood a little bit.
So Tim, is jet lag simply a matter of screwing up your daylight night timing?
So there are two different things going on. So jet lag is if you go east and west. So your circadian rhythm is just completely borked. So what used to be lunchtime now could be kind of 4 a.m. in the morning, and your body clock has to adjust. And that is something that we all, now that flying is so prevalent, that's something that we've all experienced. Today, the paper we're going to talk about doesn't necessarily exactly address that. Instead, what they're going to do is they're going to change kind of relatively the day length, how much light you get per day. So that kind of more mirrors going from north to south. So if you go, if it's, you know, winter or summer, as you go from very north, you get kind of drastically different day length versus nighttime length. Whereas if you go to the equator, then the difference between day and night would be much, much shorter, if at all. So it's actually, I didn't think about this very much until I read this paper, but animals have had to evolve how to adjust to this change in day length. So for example, you can imagine like migrating birds and stuff, and even like butterflies and insects, they usually go from very far north down to like close to the equator during migration. So they have to adapt. I know less about mammals, how much they migrate, but the reason to be sensitive to like when nighttime is and to when daytime is can be very varied. So in the paper, in the discussion, I haven't even talked about who the authors are. Let's go right to the paper. I haven't even started going on the background without talking about the paper.
And I will say, like, you know, Andy Humoon has sort of made this a very popular topic, because on his podcast, he tells everyone one of the best ways to healthy living is to entrain your circadian rhythm by just going outside at sunset and sunrise. There's something special about the wavelength of light that your eyes get at that time of day that seems to activate some circadian resetting.
Interesting.
I would challenge that based on zero scientific evidence. And the reason is, I don't really listen to other brain podcasts. I mainly listen to Twiv. But the reason is so it's quite interesting. As it happens, so we listeners might know that our eyes detect light mainly using our photoreceptors on cone cells and rod cells. So rod cells are the one that you see in low light conditions. So those are the ones that you see like when you try to see stars at night. And they don't really tell you what color things are. Whereas cone cells comes in three flavors, red, blue, and green, and they tell you what color things are. But what's interesting is that scientists a long time ago, when they tried to figure out whether rods or cone cells are responsible for entraining your circadian rhythm, I didn't look into the primary sources, but they somehow deleted both rod and cone cells to see what happens. So when you do that, the animals are effectively completely blind. So they would not respond to like, you know, bright light. They don't scurry away. You can't train them to, you know, use a light cue to learn to press a button, that kind of stuff. But the circadian rhythm wasn't affected, which is completely crazy, even though these mice are effectively completely blind, as far as you can tell. And then subsequently, scientists discovered that there are another group of cells that are sensitive to light that are not your rod and cone cells, but a different kind of cells called intrinsically photosensitive.
Yeah, these are the melanopsin cells.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And those cells, when you delete those guys, then the mice, I think the vision isn't too badly affected. Don't quote me on that. I didn't look into it. But what did definitely get affected is circadian rhythm. And those cells are actually sensitive mainly to blue light, kind of light spectrum between blue and green.
Right. But that's, I think, Huberman's point, is that there's more UV light coming in with an angle of the sun.
Yeah. So like the red lights get scattered as the sun has to take a longer path through the atmosphere. That's why you see all the beautiful colors. So maybe you see more, relatively more blue and green light, but you think the midday sun is really the one that gives you the most amount of light anyway.
So,
but maybe it's pretty to go outside during sunset and sundown.
So people who can't see, they can still sense photoperiod.
I can't remember if it's mice or some other animals, but in animals that were engineered to lose their cones and rod cells, they still have a circadian rhythm.
Interesting.
But in humans, I don't know if there are conditions where you lose your rods and cones, so you are blind in kind of image formation, yeah. but still have your retinal ganglion cell intact. So I don't know about that. It's often you, if you have injury, you lose all of them together, as far as I can tell. But I'm not an ophthalmologist.
So the question is whether blind people get jet lag or not, right?
Exactly. So it depends on. So if the damage is kind of in the retinal ganglion cell, yeah. like kind of part of the optic nerve, then you would not see it. Is the idea. Having said that, light is not the only thing that entrains you to circadian rhythm. So for example, even blind mice, they can have circadian rhythm, mainly because people who come and feed them and the husbandry people, they themselves have circadian rhythm. So if there are other cues that provide the kind of contextual cues, like you feed your mice every day at 12, then they would start developing a rhythm to that. Anyway, huge digression. Let's go to the paper. So today's paper, we're going to talk about circadian rhythm and how we adapt to it. And the title is called Adaptation to Photoperiod via Dynamic Neurotransmitter Segregation. That's a mouthful. We'll go into it. But it is published in Nature in 2024, so not too long ago. And it is the first author is Maladoni. Actually, there are only four authors. So they are Maladoni, Chang, Senft, and last author is Susan Damacki. And they are at Harvard, I believe. They're at Harvard Medical School. As we were saying earlier, during summer and winter, especially in the northern and very southern latitudes, you get very differences in day length. And if you're up in the Arctic Circle, then it literally becomes, you know, dark for, you know, 3 months or something like that. And it's important for kind of wildlife, for life form to really adapt to this, mainly because animals are either active during the day cycle or the night cycle. And if you're hunting them, you really want to catch them at the right time. So for prey hunting, also for you yourself being hunted, and also for things like temperature reasons, you might want to really adapt to be really sensitive to when the sun is coming out. Our body respond to this kind of circadian rhythm via a lot of kind of internal state modulation. For example, metabolism shows circadian rhythm. Our body temperature change as a function of time during day. Hormone secretion. I'm reading from the introduction. Hormone secretion changes. Physical activity, as we all know, and also how awake we are during the day, obviously, is also governed by our circadian rhythm. And also, if I remember some of discussion that Vincent had with immune podcasts, even your immune system changes as a function of time during the day, and potentially when you want to get receive your vaccine jab might be affected by time during the day. So circadian rhythm is quite important. And as anyone who has kind of taken a flight know that light also is a very important cue to us in training our circadian rhythm. And again, the treatment for the seasonal affective disorder up in the Scandinavian countries is just looking at a very bright light in the morning. In our paper today, the researchers are interested in what is the brain mechanism for adapting to this kind of photoperiod change. So we know that, for example, mice, if you lengthen the day or shorten the day, physical activity would actually change accordingly. So mice are different from humans. They are actually nocturnal. So they tend to run around more during the nighttime and during the daytime. So when there's bright light, they tend to sleep. So as you extend the nighttime, what mice tend to do is they gradually wake up early and earlier to when the light gets turned off. Whereas if you shorten the nighttime, so the daytime is now longer, what the mice do is they sleep earlier and earlier. So as soon as the light goes on, they kind of stop moving around, stop running around, and they try to go home and get some rest. And it has previously been found that there are several candidate in the brain that is important for this kind of circadian rhythm. So the main one that is interesting is a new brain region in the hypothalamus, part of the brain that is under, as the name tells you, under a different bit of the brain called the thalamus. There's this nucleus in the hypothalamus called suprachiasmatic nucleus, SCN for short. And this nucleus is directly above the optic chiasm. So optic chiasm is a place where the optic nerve from both your eyes cross and is kind of sitting in kind of pretty much directly in the middle of the brain at the basal part, like the bottom of the middle of the brain. And as the optic chiasm, as the optic nerve crosses, some of them send nerves to the SCN, the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And the SCN really is, people have found to be the kind of the conductor of this circadian rhythm, complicated circadian rhythm orchestra. So all your cells in your bodies apparently have a circadian rhythm, even your liver cells or your skin cells and stuff. So if you grow your cells in a dish, you would see gene expression change kind of varies as a function of 24 hours. But most of these cells, if they're isolated in a dish, the circadian rhythm apparently can kind of get messed up gradually. And the main bit of your body whose circadian rhythm actually never gets messed up, even when you isolate it, is our cells from the SCN, neurons from the SCN. They actually keep the rhythm very well. And what's really interesting is people have found that, first of all, if you lesion the SCN, so if you zap it or delete it using neuroscience technique, the animal would completely lose its circadian rhythm. So it would have no circadian rhythm. But they have found, there are also mutants, and I think this was done in hamster. There are mutant hamsters whose circadian rhythm, due to genetic mutation, is slightly shorter. So instead of 24 hours, it's like 20 hours. You can, in hamsters whose suprachiasmatic nucleus has been lesioned, you can put in a transplant of SCN from the mutant that has a shorter circadian rhythm. And these normal wild-type hamsters whose previous circadian rhythm was 24 hours, once it has received a 20-hour SCN transplant, it itself become a 20-hour creature. So its circadian rhythm actually completely gets dictated by the SCN, even though the rest of the cells don't have this mutation. So that tells you that the SCN really is the conductor of this orchestra. And the SCN, as it happens, the SCN talks to a lot of places, to the rest of the brain to kind of orchestrate the circadian rhythm. But what we don't really know is what in turn talks to the SCN so that when there are changes in daylight, it can help your body entrain. And the lab that we're talking about today have previously worked on a group of serotonergic nucleus, serotonergic neurons. So these are neurons that make and secrete serotonin. And these neurons, they have their cell bodies situated in kind of the brainstem, maybe midbrain, kind of below your cerebellum. So kind of towards the top of your neck, roughly. And the neurons live in a place called median Rafe nucleus, the MRN. Although I've also heard people pronounce it as median Rafe nucleus, if they're French, but I've heard it Rafe in England, so I'll say Rafe.
I call it Rafe.
So Jason is French. So yeah, either Rafe or Rafe. So these serotonin neurons, as it turns out, so serotonin neurons are very important because, as we know, a lot of antidepressants, speaking of seasonal affective disorder, a lot of antidepressants are SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. And they act by, we think, although jury's still out, they act by perhaps boosting the level of serotonin. So as it turns out, serotonin themselves, serotonergic neurons, project to the SNC, and can communicate with the cells in SNC. So how do the researchers in this paper showed that by having the use actually a genetic mechanism where they previously found that there are certain serotonergic cells or serotonin cells in the mRNA, in the Raphe nucleus, that express a couple of kind of markers that they can use. So one of the markers is called N1 and the other one is called PET1. Don't worry about those alphabet soup things. They are basically transcription factors and just genes that are somehow selectively expressed by these serotonin neurons that define them. So there are other serotonin neurons inside this nucleus that go elsewhere and they express different types of markers. But using these markers, they can actually engineer animals using the CRELOX, complicated CRELOX mechanism. Basically, these cells, they can engineer these cells to make specific scissors that recognize specific sequences, use those specific sequences to somehow make the cell glow green. So via doing that kind of genetic engineering, they made these serotonin neurons glow green, and they fused the green fluorescent protein, the GFP, to another protein called synaptophysin. So synaptophysin is a protein that is very important for presynaptic terminals and all the vesicles in your presynaptic terminals. So going a little bit of background, so neurotransmitters such as serotonin is actually packaged into vesicles. And these vesicles, whenever there's an action potential, these vesicles that live in the presynaptic terminal, they get released, and so that the neurotransmitter can get dumped into the synapse. And for these vesicles to work properly, there are a lot of kind of presynaptic terminal proteins, and synaptophysin is one of them. So if you fuse GFP to synaptophysin, then you can actually see each of the synaptophysin, and that tells you where the presynaptic terminals are. And these researchers can actually label these serotonin neurons that go from the median Raphe nucleus using this GFP. And they find all these little puncta, these presynaptic terminals in the SCN, in the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is the body circadian clock kind of conductor. So that tells them that that the serotonin neuron might be projecting to the SCN. Which is not too surprising because people have previously found that serotonin is quite important for the circadian rhythm. But a slight twist in the story is that, as it turns out, serotonin neurons don't just make serotonin. They actually also make and release another neurotransmitter called glutamate. And the reason why why we know that serotonin releases glutamate is because they actually make a different gene, different protein called VGLUT3, which stands for vesicular glutamate transporter number 3. And these guys are proteins whose job is to transport glutamate or glutamic acid into the vesicles. So they package glutamate from your cell body into the presynaptic terminal's vesicles to be released. So glutamate actually is just one of the 22 amino acids that your body needs and uses to make protein. But any neurons that has this vesicular glutamate transporter made, they would be able to load these glutamate into the vesicles and release it. So the fact that these serotonin neurons make this VGLUT3, this glutamate transporter, tells you that these serotonin neurons don't just release glutamate. Make and release serotonin. They also make and release glutamate. And that actually is quite a shock to people when it's first discovered, because for a long time, at least, well, before my time, people used to think that one neuron type would make one neurotransmitter. So either you are glutamate neurons, or you're a GABA neuron. A GABA is an main inhibitory neurotransmitter in the brain. Or you're a dopamine neuron, or you're a serotonin neuron, or you're an acetylcholine neuron. But people have since found that actually neurons can release several different kind of neurotransmitters. So for example, a lot of dopamine neurons can co-release glutamate and sometimes co-release GABA. is how choline neurons, especially some of the interneurons in the striatum, they can co-release glutamate and GABA.
And that's just the classical neurotransmitters. I think this idea that there's particular one neurotransmitter per neurons is now, I would say, out the water. But there's all these neuropeptides as well that sort of get co-released with things like vasopressin and oxytocin. Neuromodulators, I think, are the next big thing in neuroscience, because understanding how they affect a lot of these dynamics is going to be key.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what this paper will get into. So this paper has shown that, and we know this actually already, is that one single type of neurotransmitter can release different types of, sorry, one single type of neuron can release different types of neurotransmitter. But even then, a lot of it, like, it is unknown whether the release of neurotransmitter are to different sites. Like, for example, are they even loaded into the same vesicles? Or are the vesicles kind of individually packaged? And if they're individually packaged, are they released at the same place or are they released at different places? So to kind of examine that, what the researchers did is that they they got these mice that express synaptophysin GFP. So they can label the presynaptic boutons of these serotonin neurons that project from the median Raphe nucleus, kind of in your brainstem, to the SCN, to your suprachiasmatic nucleus, kind of in the middle of your brain at the bottom. And when they looked at these kind of presynaptic boutons, they can also, using immunolabeling, ask a question: do those boutons also express any VGlut3, this vesicular glutamate transporter? And what they found is that, surprisingly, no, these boutons in the SCN, in your circadian rhythm center, these serotonin neurons, bouton, don't seem to express VGlut3, the glutamate transporter, even though when they go back to the soma, they can see these VGlut3 transporter richly expressed inside the Raphe nucleus. And so this is somewhat surprising. They then asked the question, well, do these serotonin neurons that project to the SCN, that talk to the circadian rhythm kind of control center, do they also talk to other bits of the brain? And if so, do those other bits of the brains have VGlut3? Do they have the glutamate transporter? So the way they did that was to, they just look for the brain, search the brain to look for this synaptophysin GFP, because they know that these synaptophysin GFP are only expressed by these serotonin neurons, and they're only expressed at the presynaptic terminals. So wherever they see this GFP puncture, these boutons, that must be where the serotonin neurons are talking to. So they found these puncture in two other brain regions. One is called the paraventricular nucleus of the thalamus. So that's in the thalamus. And another place that I've never heard of is called the septofimbrial nucleus. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, Jason, because it's quite closer to the hippocampus. But it's kind of in the very anterior bit of the hippocampus, but not in the hippocampus. So it's like kind of tip. So they found the serotonin neurons to project to both these two other nuclei. But what's interesting is that in the septofimbrial nucleus, in the SFI, they saw very rich glutamate, vesicular glutamate transporter. So, like, let's see what the numbers are. Well, a lot of them express, I think, like maybe 80%, maybe close to 100% of these synaptophysin GFP positive boutons, so all the presynaptic terminals of the serotonin neurons, they also express VGlut3, this glutamate transporter, only in SFI. But in the PVT, in the paraventricular thalamus, similar to the SCN in our circadian rhythm control center, there's very little of this glutamate transporter expressed. So this leads the researcher to conclude that that there's actually branch segregation of this neurotransmitter release. So glutamate is only released, they speculate, glutamate can only be released in SFI because that's the only place is EV3. But glutamate is not released in the paraventricular thalamus and also in our SCN, the circadian rhythm control center. So this is kind of, this is a, for me, a very shocking, somewhat crazy finding, because I would think it's kind of similar to, imagine you're in a pub and someone is serving you beer on tap. And under those tap, there's a big barrel that, for whatever reason, the barman has mixed in Guinness and, like, I don't know, like Bud Light together in this barrow. But somehow the barrow, as it comes to the tap, you pull one tap and only Guinness comes out. And you pull another tap and only Bud Light comes out. And somehow the one barrow can segregate the two different types of beer. It's almost as kind of, it's a stretching analogy, but it's kind of as crazy, like it's kind of as surprising as that, is that somehow the cell can know which where each of the protein can go based on in the axon branch. So that's quite interesting. But what the researchers next asked the question was that, so we know that the SCN, the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is the circadian rhythm kind of command center, we know that it is involved in detecting these photoperiod change, so like duration of day length and day and night length. It is very important. So if we, and also there's another kind of somewhat weird finding people have found, is that when you shift the day length, if you make it longer, kind of cells inside the SCN can actually modulate what neurotransmitter it makes. So that's a different story that we're not going to go into here. But the SCN itself can change if you change the daylight cycle. So the researchers were wondering, well, is any of that caused by serotonin of changing its characteristics? The serotonin neurons changing its characteristics. And perhaps this VGLUT3 might be involved. So what they did was they once again used these mice that have somatophysin GFP in these serotonin neuron terminals in the SCN and also in the paraventricular thalamus in these different regions that they talked to. And all they did was they got these mice and they just changed the housing condition from an equinox condition, which is 12-hour day, 12-hour night, very boring, kind of if you're living on the equator, that's what you get. They changed from that to either a short daylight, a short photoperiod length, which is 5 days of light and 19 days of darkness, or long photoperiod length, which is flipped. So 19 hours of night and 5 hours day. I hope I got those right. But you guys get what I mean. So a long day or a short day. And what's interesting is when the mice are under the baseline equinox duration, you see basically most of the presynaptic terminals in the SCN, in the circadian control center, they don't have this glutamate transporter. So they're not going to be able to release glutamate. But when you lengthen the day, you see an increase to about 30% of these butons now actually also co-express glutamate transporter, suggesting maybe they're starting to release glutamate. And also, kind of slightly counterintuitively, if you shorten the day, you get a further boost of these butons. Now maybe 60 to 70% of these butons are making this glutamate transporter. So just to recap, based when you have same day and night cycle, so equinox day length, there's no glutamate transporter in the serotonin terminals. But as you change it, either long or shorter day, you get an increase in glutamate terminals in the SCN, in your circadian command center. And you might be wondering, oh, maybe the butons themselves change. Are there just changes in the number of presynaptic terminals? And the researchers found there's no change. So the number of serotonin terminals are the same, but the proportion of them that express a glutamate transporter actually change. And they also looked at the other two projection targets from the serotonin neurons from the median Rafe nucleus. So the projection to the thalamus, if you remember, to the PVT, the paraventricular thalamus, when the day and night are the same length, there was pretty much no terminals express the glutamate transporter. But once again, as you change the day-night cycle, now drastically more terminals now express this glutamate transporter. Whereas in the SFI, in another different terminals, most of them already express glutamate transporter, even under baseline. So when you change it, all of them still express glutamate transporter. So this tells you that as these authors call it, these axon branch segregation of this neurotransmitter, it itself can be regulated by the environment. So in this case, by the daylight duration. So the next thing the researchers try to do.
I would say that, you know, this concept is kind of crazy because we talked about one transmitter per neuron, but it's also thought that the kind of neurotransmitter generally, the kind of neuron, whether it's an excitatory or inhibitory, is well defined early in development. And once it's there, that's it. And so they're saying, that this is super plastic, that you can suddenly, the neuron can suddenly synthesize a completely new neurotransmitter at the synapse.
Yeah. And it gets regulated. And I think a lot of those original kind of maybe dogma or kind of simplifying assumption that one neuron, one neurotransmitter or fixed neurotransmitter throughout its lifetime is getting kind of second looks by researchers. So for example, a researcher called Nick Spitzer at UCSD, he's found that when you change the photoperiod, like when you change the daylight duration, the dopamine in hypothalamus cells can drastically increase or decrease the amount of dopamine that it makes. So it almost turns it into a non-dopamine neurons. So it's definitely, and also like there are other cells, for example, in the striatum, glutamate cells can like up or down regulate its GABAergic neurotransmission. So it's really, and we don't fully know what the function of some of those things, some of these kind of neurotransmitter switching, as they call it, this is another form of, like Jason said, it's another form of plasticity and encoding our environment. And yeah, this paper is one of the many that I'm sure would come up to tell us, let us know what is like, what the functions are. But the next experiment that these researchers did, so for those following along, I didn't really do a good job of telling you what figures we're looking at, but we are now in figure, we previously talked about figure one, but we've been talking about figure two as well as we change the photoperiod. So these researchers are asking the question, well, what is the mechanism? How can a neuron send, suddenly upregulate its VGlut3, this glutamate transporter, and then send it just to like down this certain branch? So to look at that, what they did was they, once again, using the genetic, using these GFP labeled mice to look at the serotonin neurons that that project to the SCN, to the circadian command control. And they just asked a question, as we lengthen they shorten the day length because that's the one that changed the glutamate transporter expression the most in the SCN. When we shorten the day length, if we look at back in the soma, look back at the cell body inside the median Rafe nucleus in the brainstem, do we see an increase in gene expression of the glutamate transporter? And surprisingly, there's no changes of glutamate transporter inside the cell body. Mm-hmm. So it's not because there's an upregulation of glutamate transporter expression, and then those just get kind of distributed throughout the axons. And the next thing they looked at is, well, it's not global VGlut3 mRNA transcription. Maybe there has been report that mRNA can be shipped down an axon and it can be locally translated by maybe ribosomes in the axons or in the axon terminals. So what they did to try to examine that is use these mice called ribotac mice, where they actually put in, they engineered these mice that express basically a marker, a label called an HA tag. Vince will know about HA, it's part of flu. But they basically, it's a peptide tag that mammalian cells normally don't make. So you can label it really well. And the tag are fused to the ribosome. And using genetic engineering tricks, the same trick that made the GFP only in the serotonin neurons, they can use the same trick to make this ribo tag, HA tag, only in the ribosome in these serotonin neurons. So now what they can do is try to label these tag and see if these tags are seen in the cell body, which they did see these tags in the cell body, but how about in the axon terminals in the suprachiasmatic nucleus? So somewhat surprisingly, they saw basically no kind of labeling in the SCN, the circadian center, above background. I'm a little bit surprised by that because people have been doing kind of ribosomal profiling of like the optic nerve to kind of show evidence that there is axon translation of mRNA. But that, at least using the ribotag, maybe the ribotag system isn't sensitive enough, so we don't quite know. So the researchers concluded that it does not seem like it is due to local translation of glutamate transporter mRNA. So they valiantly ruled out a couple of potential mechanisms, but we still don't know what the mechanism is. It's possible. Another possibility is that VGlu3 protein is made in the cell body, and somehow there's a machinery to ship it to the axons. But that this machinery is upregulated by changing the photoperiod. So that is still a huge question mark, is what is the mechanism? So it would be good to learn about that in the future. But having made an effort to look at the mechanism of how this neurotransmitter can be segregated, the researchers next asked, well, this ramping up of VGlu3, this ramping up of this glutamate transporter in the SCN, in the circadian command center, does it do anything? Is it important for the mice adaptation to this changing of photoperiod? So to look at that, once again, they utilize the genetic trick. And what these researchers did was they engineered a mouse, or they collaborated with someone who engineered a mouse that put some scissors cutting site around the VGlut3 gene. So the VGlut3 gene is the gene that makes the glutamate transporter that we're interested in here. So you can knock it out globally in all the cells if you want to, but a better way of doing it is to knock it out only in the cells that you're interested in. And the way to do that is what researchers have done in basically all of biology now is they have done a kind of a flexible way of engineering ways of knocking out genes kind of selectively in certain cell types. Is what you do is you put certain sequences flanking your gene of interest, and these sequences are recognized by certain molecular scissors that you can then engineer only in your cell of interest. So that's what they did. They engineered these molecular scissors. They use a AAV virus to basically make these kind of scissors that only recognize these specific cut sites only in the serotonin neurons. And by doing that, they can cut out the VGlut3 gene only in the serotonin neurons. And so the researchers did a bunch of kind of control, kind of sanity check experiment to show that once they've done this, the VGlut3 transcript inside these serotonin neurons are reduced. So having shown that, they can now ask the question, well, if we knock out this glutamate transporter in all mice all the time, does it do anything to the adaptation to the photoperiod? So they first tested these. I forgot to mention another very important thing. I skipped ahead. They actually were able to use virus. The scissor cutting sites that is around the VGlut3 require molecular scissors. And what the researchers did was they injected a virus, an AAV virus, that would make the scissors that recognize these cut sites. But the virus is injected directly into the SCN, which is the circadian command control center. And the virus have a capsid that preferentially allows it to be taken up by axon terminals. So what that means is the serotonin neurons that come from your brainstem, your midbrain brainstem in the Rafe nucleus, those terminals will preferentially take up these AAV that are making these scissors and go back to the serotonin cell body, serotonin neuron cell body, make those scissors and selectively affect the VGlu3 knockout inside the serotonin neurons. So this is a very nice way of selectively targeting the subpopulation that goes from the median Rafe nucleus to the SCN while sparing kind of, you know, potentially other projection. So when they did that, they show that they can, you know, decrease the VGlu3 transcript inside the Rafe nucleus. And the first question is they asked is, well, when you get rid of these glutamate transporter, does it affect any light-dark cycle activity, even under baseline condition where it's 12-hour day, 12-hour night? And the way they assay this is they stuck a running wheel inside the mice's home cage and just looked at kind of the activity pattern during the day. And normal mice, they would run, mice are nocturnal, so they, whenever the light goes out, the mice wake up and they start running in the wheel. They like wheel running. Oh, I don't know whether you guys seen this. There's a, when I was just looking up, digging up background for this paper, I was looking at wheel running. As it turns out, if you put a wheel, some researchers have done this. If you just put a, we're wondering, like if you put a wheel in a kind of a pet mouse home cage, the mouse like to run. But the question is it because the mouse likes to run in general, or is it because there's nothing to do and that's the only thing they can do? So what researchers have done is some researchers have put a mouse running wheel out in the wild and then just put a camera on it to see what goes and run. And you see like all these creatures, like of course, wild mice apparently also like to run, so they keep going back to run. And then other creatures also start coming out and using the running wheel. So I see a frog using the running wheel, trying to jump around. And then like a slug is using the running wheel. So apparently running wheel is, as anyone who's done kind of gone jogging and stuff, like exercise can be quite, can itself be rewarding. And exercise itself can also help entrain your photoperiod. I don't know if the Huberman podcast talk about this or not. Anyway, going back to the paper, they've shown that normal mice, as you turn the light off, the mouse start running on the running wheel. So that is part of the circadian rhythm. And when you knock out the glutamate transporter, these mice are completely the same. So when the light is on, they sleep, they don't run. And as soon as the light comes off, the mouse start running. So there's no baseline differences in these mice. But as soon as you switch the light period so that the photoperiod is now much shorter, so there's a lot less daylight, a lot more dark, nighttime night, what you see in the control mice, so the control mice would still have the glutamate transporter, what you see them do is they gradually start running earlier and earlier during the day. So so you can divide the day into time of day. They call it Zeitgeber time, I think. It's German. I think it stands for time giver time. I have no idea. I don't speak German. I do apologize. I should have looked this up. But it tells you basically when, kind of like a marker of kind of your circadian time. So as you make the light turn off earlier during the day, the mice gradually start running earlier and earlier in the kind of the time of day, Zeitgeber time. So instead of waking up, say, at 10 in the morning, these mice now wake up at 8 in the morning and start going for the jog. Interestingly, in the glutamate transporter knocked out mice, they adapt much more slowly. So they still adapt. They still eventually start running earlier, but this slope of adaptation is much shallower, which tells you that they take a lot longer to adapt. The researcher also asked the opposite question. If you lengthen the photoperiod, so now there's much more daylight, 19 hours of daylight and 5 hours of nighttime, does it change anything to the kind of this wheel running activity? So in the control mice, if you make the day longer, they now no longer run at the normal time. Instead, they wait until the light has gone off So they have to wait longer before they start running. And this adaptation is very, very rapid. It takes like maybe a couple of sessions and the mice already adapt. Whereas if you make the daylight, if you make the nighttime longer, so our previous experiment, so that the mice have to wake up earlier, it takes normal mice like 15 days to adapt. And the researchers think it's because light is actually aversive to mice because they are nocturnal. So they would not suddenly wake up and run if there's still light outside. But in the mice whose glutamate transporter got knocked out in the serotonin neurons, the adaptation is again slower. So these mice would still go for a few jogs, even though there's light outside, even though it is not their normal jogging time. So this kind of tells you that this glutamate transporter is important. It doesn't just correlate with changing in photo period. It also causally is important for the adaptation. And the next experiment the researcher did is a kind of like a complementary experiment where instead of looking at the activity, they looked at the kind of like the running activity of the mice. They looked at the sleep-wake cycle of the mice. And to do that, they basically put on a wireless device that would record the EEG, so the brainwave of the animal, and also the EMG, so the muscle tone of the neck muscles of the animal. So by doing this, you can really map when the mouse is moving, when it's in the non-REM sleep. So that's kind of like the slow wave deep sleep that people sometimes talk about, and also the REM sleep. And that is the one where you have rapid eye movement sleep. It's correlated with dreaming, and also your muscle is completely atonic. So your muscle don't move unless you have REM sleep disorder, unless you're sleepwalking or have REM sleep disorder, which is bad news. And you act out your dream. But this just allows the researchers to track when the mouse is awake, when the mouse is undergoing REM sleep, and also non-REM sleep. And what they found was, once again, in control mice, when they make when they shorten the photo period, so they make the day shorter, so the nighttime longer, these mice gradually wake up early and earlier during the day so that they match when the light turns off. And similarly, the REM sleep and the non-REM sleep also gradually adapts accordingly. Interestingly, in the mice whose glutamate transporter is knocked out, they show a complete lack of adaptation. So as they lengthen the nighttime, these mice did not wake up earlier and earlier. And that actually stands in contrast to the previous experiment where they had a running wheel in the cage. So when they had a running wheel in the cage, these mice with a glutamate transporter knockout, they still adapted. They just adapted more slowly. But if you take away this running wheel, the mouse now no longer adapt as assayed by the sleep-wake EEG protocol. So it suggests that the presence of a running wheel might actually help and train the mouse to the change in daylight cycle, which is quite interesting. And the next thing that the researchers also did was they briefly looked at, we know that the suprachiasmatic nucleus, the circadian rhythm command center, the gene expression, expression of several genes in there also has a 24-hour kind of cycle pattern. For example, there's a gene called PER1, which is one of the clock genes that's important for circadian rhythm. Another gene that is has this circadian rhythm is FOS, which is an immediate early gene. So what the researchers found was that when they shorten the photo period, the control mice actually change the peak of the expression of these kind of circadian rhythm sensitive genes, they changed to match the shortening of the photo period. Whereas in the mouse with the glutamate transporter knockout, this change didn't seem to happen. The peak is similar to where other studies have found, you know, when you have 12-hour day-night cycle, the peak should be. So it suggests that these, when you knock out glutamate transporter in the serotonin neurons, these mice completely fail to adapt to the photo period change again. This tells you that the glutamate transporter is kind of not just correlate with photoperiod change, it causally is very important with the adaptation, the behavioral and adaptation of the changing of photoperiod. So finally, we're coming to the very last experiment. We're now on, previously we're talking about figure three and four for those keeping track. Now we're going to move on to figure five and six. So the very last bit of the experiment, as we come to a close, the researchers want to find a bit more about the circuitry. So we have found that the Rafe nucleus, the serotonin neurons, play a role in telling you to adapt to changing in daylight length. But who talks to the serotonin neurons? So to do that, the researchers did a very clever, use a very clever tool, which is tracing using rabies virus. So maybe we don't, we're short of time, so we don't have time to talk about this, unfortunately, but it's sometime in the future, maybe we can spend some time talking about this. Researchers have kind of engineered rabies virus to allow you to track what cells, let's say I'm interested in what cells talk to my cell, cell population A. So for cell population A, I want to label all the synaptic input that come to population cell A. So let's call them cell B. Oh, that doesn't help. But basically all the synaptic input to a certain population, you can basically use rabies to label all the cells that talk to your cell of interest. And that's because the way rabies infects cells is it jumps synapse and actually gets retrogradedly transported up your axon. And then to your cell body, it crosses the synapse and then infects the neuron previous to it. So by doing this, the researchers can infect serotonin neurons inside the Rafe nucleus using these engineered rabies. The serotonin neurons, and they can do it so that only the serotonin neurons that they're interested in gets infected. The serotonin neurons would then release rabies virus, and these rabies virus are engineered to make GFP. So as they infect the neurons that talks to these serotonin neurons, those neurons that talk to it would turn green. So using this, they can actually track what cells talk to the serotonin neurons in the Rafe nucleus. And they have four candidates. One of them is in the preoptic area in the hypothalamus. So that's actually an area that I think Vivian talked about last week about parental behavior. So that's also in the hypothalamus. Another area is called is the lateral hypothalamus, known to be very important in feeding. Another area is lateral habenula, which is important potentially in depression. And finally, the VTA, the ventrotegmental area, which is an area that is important for mood and reward. It makes a lot of dopamine. It's where the dopamine cell body lives. So all these cells actually project to the Rafe nucleus serotonin neurons. And the researchers did more experiments to show that they really potentially are making a synaptic connection. But the next thing that they really want to do is they want to ask, if we silence these these brain regions that talk to the Rafe nucleus, so once again, it's the preoptic area in the hypothalamus, the lateral hypothalamus, and the lateral habenula. So that of these upstream areas, if we silence them, can we then also affect the photoperiod change? And can we also affect this glutamate transporter kind of trafficking or kind of glutamate transporter expression in the terminals in the suprachiasmatic nucleus? So what the researchers did was they engineered these cells. They have mice. They have engineered mice that express tetanus toxin, and the tetanus toxin function is to inhibit presynaptic release. That's probably one of the reasons why you get sick. So these mice would make tetanus toxin only in the cells, but the tetanus toxin itself is flanked by, again, these specific The tetanus toxin itself can only be expressed if the cell is making these specific molecular scissors that cut away, you know, like a stop codon that gets in the way. And again, to identify these brain regions that are specifically sending projections to the Raphe nucleus, the researchers again did kind of like a clever engineering trick where they injected a virus into the Raphe nucleus that would retrograde greatly be transported back to from the axon terminals back to the upstream region. So, for example, if the preoptic area is sending axons to the Raphe nucleus, you can inject a virus into the Raphe, and the virus would be uptaken by axon terminals and go back to the preoptic area. And you can inject a second virus inside the preoptic area that, in combination with the first virus that you inject, would together make this molecular scissors that would recognize your tetanus toxin to allow your tetanus toxin to be expressed. It's quite complicated. I try my best. But it's all very clever engineering tricks using cell biology, using molecular biology. And by doing that, they can really isolate just the cells that are projecting from the preoptic area to the Raphe nucleus, to the serotonin neurons. And when they did that, what they found is that if they inhibit the synaptic release of the upstream area from the lateral hypothalamus or the lateral habenula, there's no change. It doesn't really affect the mouse's adaptation to photoperiod change, and it doesn't affect the glutamate transporter expression in the suprachiasmatic nucleus, the circadian rhythm command center. But if they inhibit the neuron that goes from the preoptic area in the hypothalamus to the serotonin neurons in the median Raphe, what they then found was that even without any photoperiod change, even when the cells, when the mice are housed in a 12-hour day-night cycle, there's now many more glutamate transporter expressed in the suprachiasmatic nucleus in the circadian command center. Suggesting that the mouse might, you know, be under a constant state of photoadaptation, kind of potentially. But when they then put these mice into a shorter photoperiod to ask, are they now better at photoadaptation? What they actually found is the opposite, is that these mice are impaired in photoadaptation. So, which is a little bit complicated. So it suggests that there might be an optimum level of VGlut3 that are optimum level of glutamate transporter inside your circadian command center that needs to be there at the right time to tell you when to adapt to the photoperiod. So if you mess with that by inhibiting the upstream region, the POA that talks to the serotonin cells, then you can completely mess up your photoadaptation. So what the researchers conclude is that the POA, this preoptic area in the hypothalamus, is part of a kind of a complicated circuitry that orchestrates our photoadaptation. So it goes from the POA, and POA, this upstream area, is interesting because they apparently are also one of the areas that your retina, your retinal ganglion cells that detect your blue light during day rise and sunset, they also can send direct connection to the POA that then talks to the serotonin neurons in the Raphe nucleus that then talks back to the suprachiasmatic nucleus, your circadian rhythm control center, and that orchestrate your adaptation to changing in day and night, lengthening or shortening. And the crux of all this is, surprisingly, this kind of branch segregation of this glutamate from serotonin neurons released kind of non-canonically, because these are serotonin neurons. You think the serotonin is important, but it's actually the glutamate that is important in a branch-specific manner. So the researchers say that this in the discussion, they mentioned that this might be very important. This kind of circuitry might be important, not just for our adaptation from autumn or summer to autumn to winter, as we're doing right now as the temperature cools, but also as we undergo jet lag. So they didn't test jet lag per se in this particular experiment, but it's possible that this kind of system is also engaged when, if you shift the mouse's 12-hour clock, kind of just shift it by itself without lengthening or changing the length.
Is it likely that the same kind of circuit is functional in people?
It is possible. We do not know. Mm. We really do not know. One potential confound, something that we need to keep in mind, is the kind of the valence, the happiness and aversiveness of day versus night in us versus mice. So both mice and us can obviously detect when it's sunrise, when there's light and when there's dark, but the meaning is completely opposite. So for mice, light is aversive and they really don't like it, and they can get depressed when the daylight is lengthened, supposedly, according to
me. Certainly those structures are conserved and the nuclei are conserved, and I think it'd be not surprising that this kind of plasticity is conserved in terms of in training. And I mean, I think the other thing for sleep though is that mice also have a very fragmented sleep. They don't, it's not like they have this long bout of sleep and then they wake up. They sleep and then they come up and they sleep and they, so that makes it a little different, but
like me.
Yeah, but I think some of that sleeping structure might depend on if they have, say, a running wheel in the home cage. So like us, if they have work to get to, then
what's worth pointing out, of course, is that mice are nocturnal. Yet in our mouse facilities, we force them to change their period. Right, we keep the lights on all day.
There are reversed light dark cycle for some of the labs, so that to match more the mouse's natural circadian rhythm. But in our lab, we have the normal light dark cycle, and I think the mice, it's very important because it does make a difference. Yeah, it can make a huge difference. So like for example, it's known like certain neurons, the excitability can have several fold change depending on where in the night dark cycle.
Oh, immune responses too, right? Yeah. I mean, it can be totally different.
Yeah.
So you have to go in the dark, you know, you can do it.
Yeah, exactly. And we don't.
I found this paper an amazing synthesis of genetic manipulation, tracing.
Yeah.
It's four authors. It's an incredible amount of work for four authors. Right?
Yeah, exactly. There are only four authors. There's really, really a lot of work, a valiant attempt to find out how the VGlu3 is segregated.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Too bad. And maybe one day we'll have time to get into some of more of the tracing. Like, it's so fascinating, like how these tracing tools get developed. Maybe one day.
We still don't know how rabies works. I mean, why it jumps one synapse only is also not
clear. And apparently, like what kind of synapse it jumps through can depend on what kind of synapse it is. So like, for example, glutamatergic synapse, it jumps really readily, but like dopamine synapse, it jumps terribly. Mm. So reason why, I think maybe it's like, is it facing the synapse perfectly, or is it a sideways connection, or is it a dendritic connection, might be important.
But anyway, thanks, Tim. That was great. I really like that.
Yeah, in welcoming our autumn season.
It's Twin 55. You can find the show notes at microbe.tv/twin. If you have any questions or comments, twin@microbe.tv. If you enjoy these programs, we'd like to have your support. microbe.tv/contribute. Jason Shepherd is at the University of Utah. Jason Synaptic on X. Thanks, Jason.
Thanks, Tim. That was definitely a tour de force.
Tour de force. Tim Chung is at New York University. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you. Yes, it was fun presenting it and reading about it.
I'm Vincent Racaniello. You can find me at microbe.tv. You've been listening to This Week in Neuroscience. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next month.